You're listening to Potluck.
Welcome back to Golden Hour, a podcast that spotlights Asian musicians. I'm your host, Charlene Kay.
And I'm Dave Yim. Charlene, when this episode comes out, we're only going to have a few days left of 2023.
Yes, that's correct.
It's been quite a year, but we're very excited for 2024. But before we get too excited, I thought we could do a little recap of our Spotify Wrapped top artists or top songs to see what we've been listening to.
Oh my gosh,
which is always a fun rabbit hole. One thing I don't like about the Spotify Wrapped is it comes out like it came out like November 28th or something this year. It's like there's a whole month of listening that doesn't get counted.
It's true. Do they count it in the next year? Does it like
roll over? I don't think
so.
I think December is just a free for all. You can listen to whatever you want.
Okay, well, maybe that just it's unaccountable. You don't need to be accountable to Spotify. You could listen to
exactly
anything you want.
So I'm curious about what are some of your highlights?
Well, my most listened to song of 2023 is The Climb by Miley Cyrus. Because there's always going to be another mountain. I'm always going to want to make it move. It's always going to be an uphill battle. And sometimes, Dave, you're going to have to lose.
That's a like early, early song, right?
Yeah, that was from the Hannah Montana movie.
Oh my gosh. That was your top song.
I can almost see it. It's an amazing song. Let me tell you
that's
that my
incredible
my third most played song was Dirty by Christina Aguilera.
You are living in a different era. I love it.
It's actually really great because on my Hinge profile, I'm singing Sum 41's I don't want to waste my time, Fat Lip. Mm-hmm. And someone actually responded and said, act your age.
Wow.
And I'm like, bro, I am acting my age. I'm 37. This is what
yeah, exactly.
I was listening to.
What, you think like a 19-year-old's going to be into Sum 41? Like, give me a break.
But, I mean, he has a point. I am a teenage boy at heart.
Well, so, I mean, my Spotify Wrapped is very telling in that my top five bands are all pop punk bands. And not like old ones, like new ones. So I am very much living in a weird space where I'm like into new pop punk, but it's also like I have the listening habits also of a teenage boy.
Let's hear it.
So it's the story so far, Knuckle Puck, Real Friends, The Menzingers, and State Champs were my top five.
Wow,
bands.
That's like five for five. You did not have genre diversity.
It's actually, it's a little embarrassing too. I think for me, it's definitely like a comfort genre. Mm-hmm. It's just kind of like a white noise. You know, simple melodies. It's all just loud, kind of like in the background. You can just like let it play. I will say, so I also use an app called Last.fm, which if there's any music nerds out there, you know that this is like, you can keep track of all of your music stats. So it links up to your Spotify, but it also links up to any other music service you use. So I also listen to my Apple Music and I download music and I sometimes listen to MP3s still because I'm old school like that. So Last.fm also counts that. So here's the loophole. There's one thing that was not counted on my Spotify Wrapped, which was actually friend of the pod, Nono Boy. And that was because I was traveling in Asia in February, specifically Vietnam, and I had his record on a lot because he talks a lot about, you know, Vietnam and you know he's Vietnamese, and I was just really inspired by his songwriting, and so I was actually listening to that on my Apple Music or my music app on my phone, not on Spotify. So there's a little wild card.
All right. We love to support friends of the pod.
We love the support. So Julian, if
shout
you're listening,
out Julian,
shout out.
Twice Southern with two civil wars. A fool to think that this place could ever be yours. The in-between, that's where we must explore. Tell Hanoi I love her.
Also, I thought it would be fun to talk about our 2024 themes. So a friend of mine said that he comes up with a theme every year versus a resolution. Mm. So my 2023 theme was confidence.
Oh, I love that.
I just wanted to, just be confident in myself and my skills and what I was doing. So I've been thinking about this, and I think my 2024 theme is going to be into the world.
Into the world.
Which is somewhat related to
confidence. What does that mean to you?
But just putting things out into the world, engaging with the world. You know, I think it's very easy to be scared. There's a lot of scary stuff going out there, and to just, you know, recoil and retract and hide from it. So I don't want to, do that. I want to engage with the world. I want the things I do to be out into the world. So that's the theme of my 2024 as we go into the new year.
I love that.
Anything
love that so much.
Come to mind for you for your 2024 themes?
I
sprung that on you.
The biggest theme of my year this year was how to rest and prioritizing rest, validating my body when it's tired by taking a nice little nap, which for us Asian overachievers is very difficult. And I've done a lot of work in therapy this year around why I turn productivity into my God and why it's so easy for me to get swept away in accomplishing things, like achieving things. And yes, it is very like, it's so wrapped up in my childhood and this need to, you know, prove my parents right by, you know, saying that I wanted to go on my wayward path, like being a musician and like being a multidisciplinary artist. Like now I'm like really making their dreams come true, because not only am I a musician, but now I'm a stand-up comedian. My dad was like, "So what is this? Is this your new thing? Is this stand-up comedy?" But yeah, I mean, I had mono over the summer, so I was sick and I was pushing through so hard because I had all these obligations that unfortunately were like awesome career opportunities. And I just found myself like really angry at my body all the time for needing rest, which is really not productive, because it's like yelling at a cat. Like, it doesn't have any idea what you're talking about. And it's just intuition, right. You know,
it
just, like
it needs what it needs.
Its own. Yeah, exactly. So my theme for next year, I think, is going to be ease. And that's tied up in like, how can I be present in every moment instead of rushing ahead to the next thing or dwelling on what happened already that I can't change? Like, how do I experience slowness in the sense of like, I'm here, I'm being present in my life. And how do I go for the things that I want to go for, which I feel like the work that I'm doing right now with this show that I've written and the album that I've written is very invigorating to me. And I want to see if it's possible to bring those into the world and like work hard, but also make time for myself and allow everything to like exist in its own space.
Yeah, I love that. It feels very sustainable.
Yes. And it has to be, because if you burn out, then nobody's benefiting by that.
Shall we intro our wonderful guest for today?
Yes, let's do it.
So I think this guest came to us from our friend Kim Chow, who saw him and his band perform at the Brooklyn Museum and texted us and was like, "This guy is awesome. You have to get him on the show." And so we did. It took some scheduling here and there. We had to reschedule. He took a trip to India. We had to postpone, but we finally got him. And it is Brooklyn-based vocalist, songwriter, trumpet player, Sunny Singh.
Gathered my child, Baggy, gathered my child.
Sunny is also a political activist and an organizer, and much of his work revolves around building community and fighting for liberation for all oppressed peoples. One of Sunny's first bands, called Outer National, was produced by Rage Against the Machine's Tom Morello. He has since gone on to produce and write and perform his own music, and just recently released his new album, Charikala, which explores the idea of revolutionary infinite optimism. Sunny's message with this new album is so powerful. It talks about this idea of ever-rising spirits, where it's like, no matter how hard the times are, or how dark the days, we have an obligation to spiritual optimism.
Here's a clip of Charikala, which is the title track off of Sunny's album.
Sunny, it is so great to have you here today. We are honored to have you on the podcast. We've been wanting to talk to you for such a long time. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure and an honor.
How's your week going?
My week is going okay. I just got back in town late last night, so I'm slightly disoriented and discombobulated, but generally glad to be home.
That's always a good feeling. Were you playing a gig?
It was a bunch of things, but most recently I came from Seattle where I had a big show premiering this new project called Many Messiahs, which is this sort of racial justice intervention in the classical music world a collective of us have been working on for like 3 years. And this was the world premiere.
Wow.
That's amazing. Wait, tell us more about that.
Yeah.
Well, it was initiated by this guy named Aaron Grad, who lives in Seattle and is kind of deep in the classical music world. And in 2020, when many people and many white people especially were like, what am I doing about racism? And more importantly, anti-racism, he started looking internally being aware of how elitist and how white and how much racism is insidious in the classical music world, he was thinking about ways to intervene in that space. And he started reaching out to a bunch of us, songwriters, composers, singers, musicians of color who already were weaving racial and social justice themes into our work, to see if we'd be interested in collaborating on this project, which specifically, at least the first iteration of it, is a reimagining of Handel's Messiah. And sort of this idea that, Handel's Messiah about Jesus, of course, but sort of reimagining it today as a Messiah, as someone who is in the struggle for social justice and liberation, and the Messiah that is in all of us. And that idea really resonated with me. I haven't really played classical music much since I was in high school. And that's the case for a lot of us that he brought together. We're not classical music people. Hmm. And so it's very much a sort of multi-genre shaking up of that world. And it was a really beautiful premiere. Lots of incredible musicians coming from a lot of different backgrounds. And so I co-composed two of the songs and played trumpet and sang backing vocals and even played, had my Glockenspiel debut. I've never,
wow.
Never played Glockenspiel before, but it got put on me and I was like, okay, I will rise to the occasion.
Yeah.
I figured it out. I literally wrote the notes like on masking tape on each I don't even know what you call each Glockenspiel element. Button.
Each Glock.
Each Glock, yeah.
Mm-hmm. He's like, it's just like a piano. I was like, that doesn't help me. I don't understand how this is the piano. So I literally was like, G, A, B, A sharp.
Oh my God. That's funny. It's funny that you say that because I understand music linearly because I started on piano. And so when I started playing guitar, I was like, oh my God, this is so different because it's all shapes and something higher could be, in a different place on the low note and vice versa.
Yeah.
And you started out playing trumpet, which is the least intuitive from my perspective.
Yeah,
it's which not... is like you only have three valves.
Valves. Did I get that right? Good. Very good. I would accept buttons.
Yeah, three buttons. I mean, they look more like buttons than the Glocks, but we'll allow it. But yeah, let's go there. I would love to hear about your beginnings in music. I know that you started playing trumpet when you were 7. Is that correct?
Nine.
Cool.
But before I ever picked up trumpet, I was playing some harmonium and tabla and singing in Sikh devotional contexts. Yeah. So I'd go to, there wasn't much of a Sikh community in Charlotte, North Carolina, where I was growing up, but once a year or so, we would go to these Sikh camps in the Raleigh-Durham area where there was a slightly bigger community. And I don't remember if it was like a few days or if it was a week or what it was, but in that space is where I started learning Sikh Kirtan, which is devotional music, which is a really, a central part of Sikh spirituality and culture. It's kind of the main thing that's happening when you go into a Gurdwara or a Sikh house of worship. And so that was in me a little bit before I ever started playing the trumpet. Harmonium and tabla both, but like on a very basic level. And I was singing and, you know, we would just kind of play harmonium unison with the vocal lines. That was kind of the vibe. And so that music and that instrument, the harmonium, still has a special place in my heart. And then I started playing trumpet in school band at age 9, pretty arbitrarily, actually.
Yeah.
But it stuck.
I remember reading that someone just kind of gave you a trumpet and you were like, you know what? This is cool. I started my musical journey on piano, but my first experience in an ensemble was playing saxophone in the fifth grade band.
Yep.
I was also 9. And I just remember getting very winded from the breath that it took to to execute sound on such a big instrument. So eventually I moved to clarinet. But it was all like, it was really interesting. Like with a wind instrument, it's similar to singing in that you're using your body to create dynamic with the sound. It's not verbal, but
right.
I'm wondering, when you were starting to play trumpet, how did you experience that as a kid? And like, how did that lead you to playing other instruments and like gravitating towards things like the harmonium and the dhal and tablas? Yeah. Like how do those expressions feel differently to you?
Yeah, I mean, I think once I got a handle on trumpet, because there's like a couple years where you just sound like shit in general. Like it's not like you can, you know, on piano, you can at least like put your three fingers on a triad and like do that at a very young age and it sounds good if the piano's in tune. With a trumpet, just like getting a decent sound out of the instrument takes quite a lot of effort.
Yeah,
or it takes a lot of learning.
It's not fun to hear someone be new to trumpet.
Yeah, it's like, you know, the lip muscles, like the face muscles, like that all takes time. And I don't remember that process too vividly at this point, but I remember practicing in the bathroom because I understand my parents did not want to hear, you know, like terrible sounding brass instrument buzzing happening. But by the time I was able to make nice sounding sounds out of the instrument, I do feel like that resonance, that sound just became a part of me. And I think it became an important part of how I sort of processed what was going on around me too. And I don't think this was in a very conscious way, you know, as somebody who, you know, grew up wearing a turban, still wears a turban, has brown skin, grew up in an immigrant family, you know, dealing with ton of racist harassment and bullying on a pretty daily basis. I think having breathing exercises like kind of inadvertently built into my days was super helpful as a way to kind of process a lot of anger, a lot of sadness, and that resonance of the trumpet. And it's still just, yeah, I mean, it became a part of my voice, a sort of extension of the way I express myself, I think in pretty important ways, emotionally. And, you know, I didn't go to music school. Like I'm not the trumpet player that has all the chops or, you know, like has all the range and can play like up in the stratosphere. You know, I'm not the trumpet player someone's going to call for the, you know, the jazz gig with, you know, like the bebop gig, like that's not me. But I think that my sound, like that the focus that I had on resonance and tone and sound as a young person is still, I think, a big part of my personality on that instrument. Just literally the way it sounds to play one note. I think so much can be communicated through a wind instrument in that way, and also as a singer in that way too.
Wow, that was a beautiful answer. Unintentional breath work.
Yeah, I mean, it's a little bit of speculation, but I do sometimes wonder, like, how I managed dealing with all that stuff, because I didn't really have outlets. I wasn't talking to anybody about it. Nobody was asking me questions. I didn't have therapy. I didn't even talk to my brother about this kind of stuff, even though he was dealing with the same stuff as me. But I do think trumpet was kind of key.
Yeah, I loved how you said how the trumpet as a wind instrument kind of becomes an extension of you. I remember seeing Bob Dylan play years ago, and his voice did not sound great. It had a certain quality about it, a gravelly quality, but it certainly was not him in his prime. However, as soon as he picked up that harmonica, it was like you were back in 1968.
Yeah, that's cool. Yeah.
And it just like transported you to the timeless, ageless Bob Dylan. And, thinking about that, what you were just saying about, that wind instrument becomes your second voice in a way that I feel like, sort of percussive based instruments like piano and guitar maybe don't have that same sort of human quality to it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's true. Most of us trumpet players have a very love-hate relationship with our instrument, so it's nice to remember the love parts sometimes. it's a very masochistic instrument in many ways. There's a physicality to it. There's a lot of pain when you overplay or when you push too hard, and that's something that I think most of us have been dealing with most of our lives.
Yeah. Well, I guess maybe we can transition to talking about your original music, because it, has a lot of sort of traditional Sikh sort of influence to it, but of course trumpet being your main instrument, it inevitably creates this fusion, which is so unique to you. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how you incorporated your background and skill as a trumpet player into your original music.
I appreciate the question. I think the way you pose it is appropriate for the process, because even the way that I just described growing up playing music, I described Sikh Kirtan and trumpet as like these very different things. Like I didn't think of Kirtan as music. That was like its own thing that happened in the community at Gurdwara. Like it wasn't music per se in my head. And then I was going to band class in elementary school, and I was doing music, which involved sheet music, and I was reading notes, right? And so I think these things were pretty siloed for a lot of my younger years. And as I became a more serious musician, trumpet and then, eventually singing too became the way that I expressed myself. And it never would have occurred to me to tap into sort of the kirtan I learned as a kid and the kirtan that I still listen to and is very much a part of my life as a Sikh. And about somewhere around 2018, I think a lot of us, like now, it was a moment where a lot of us were feeling a lot of desperation a couple of years into the Trump administration, a lot of other far right authoritarians rising to power in other parts of the world, increased police violence on Black people and communities of color, just a lot of pretty harrowing stuff happening. And it was a moment where I just found myself sitting with my harmonium and like relearning some of the shabads. We call it devotional song shabads, relearning some of the shabads that I learned as a kid and just sort of singing them to myself and like trying to remember different ones. And then digging a little bit more deeply into the meanings, because the meanings aren't always obvious to me. My Punjabi is really bad, but even if my Punjabi was good, like interpreting Sikh devotional poetry you have to do research. It's not always so obvious, because right. It's hundreds of years old, right? These are texts that are 400 or 500 years old. written in many languages, some languages that don't even exist anymore, right? So I started digging a little bit deeper and just sort of feeling the contemporary relevance of so much of this poetry that's considered sacred in our community. And so that sort of began to seep into a project. I didn't think it was going to turn into a record, but it started with me recording these videos of me playing multiple instruments, and like singing like a 1 minute clip of a shabad. And then, you know, based on my skill set, trumpet was always going to be incorporated, right? And that was a very different sound to incorporate into harmonium and dole and the other few instruments that I would put on these little clips. And you know, the internet and social media have more downsides than good, probably, than ups. But I will say, like, one of the upsides was the feedback loop I got from putting this out into the world from Sikhs and non-Sikhs alike, you know, connecting the meaning of these sacred songs to what was going on in the world really seemed to be hitting people hard and hitting me hard. And so very quickly I started going from there and writing some of my own melodies to a lot of these devotional poems, and eventually it became a record.
Life gets a little crazy sometimes. Sometimes it's confusing, sometimes it's funny, sometimes it's beautiful, and sometimes it can just piss us off. Enter First of All Podcast. It's a safe space for real conversations about the things that we all struggle with, celebrate, contemplate, and work through in our daily lives. I'm your host, Mindy Chang. I'm an actor, filmmaker, and entrepreneur with a colorful background, a full life, and brilliant friends who I love to unpack life with to share with all of you. They are everyday people like you and me, ranging from award-winning artists, cultural icons, powerful CEOs, my hilarious childhood friends, and even my mom. Tune in for honest conversations on mental health, dating, sex, family, career, culture, and everything in between. Listen to First of All wherever you find podcasts, part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
I want to go back a little bit to you growing up in North Carolina.
Yeah.
And you went to college in Arizona, right?
I did, yeah.
Where did you go to U of A?
I did.
Oh my gosh. You said Tucson in one of your interviews, and I was like, it's got to be U of A. I'm from Arizona.
Oh, no way.
Yeah, I grew up in Scottsdale.
What high school?
A Chaparral.
Shut up. One of my—
Did you go there too?
No, I didn't go to Chaparral. I had friends that did. But the reason that Chaparral is especially significant to me is because the best gig my college ska band ever got was the Chaparral High School prom.
What? No way.
They paid us like $1,200. We were like, yes. We had to learn some stupid covers, but we mostly did our thing and played our—
Stop
corny,
it.
Our corny third wave ska music.
No way.
This must have been 2000-ish.
I was there then.
Do you remember a ska band coming through?
No, I wouldn't have gone to prom then.
Would have remembered.
I definitely would have remembered. I was there from 2001 to 2005.
I just missed you.
Wow,
but that would have been incredible.
What could have been? My band was called Turban Jones.
Yes.
Wait, I got to hear, what was in your repertoire for ska?
Yeah, what was
covers?
The set list? I also want to know.
I mean, it was a lot of originals. We put out two records actually, and those are not available awesome. Anywhere. I'm happy to say they are not available anywhere. I'm trying to remember some of the covers. We did the
was
cake
like...
version of "I Will Survive." Do you remember that?
Amazing.
Yeah, very suitable for trumpet. There was one song that there was one or two songs where we did where I like left stage in protest. Because I was one of those like very self-righteous ska kids.
Oh my God.
Like there was a Blink-182 song, whatever their like big radio hit was. And I
the
left
small
the stage
things.
For that. Yes, good. Yes. I was like, I'm too proud to
You're like, this is
stand
not pure.
Up here.
Yeah.
You're like, I will
while
not
my band plays
play
this.
Trumpet on this radio
nope,
hit.
I didn't. I walked off stage.
Wow. Good for you.
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Those are
God.
The ones
the
that
pure,
are coming to
pure.
Mind.
Pure. That's pure.
Yeah. I mean, ska still has a a close place in my heart.
Oh yeah, I love it.
Yeah, I stand by it. I don't stand by that band per se. You can't hear our records.
You don't want to revive Turbin Jones?
No.
Turbin Jones. No, that's so good.
No disrespect to any members of Turbin Jones that might be hearing this. I love you all. We were great at what we were doing in that moment.
Wait, that's so funny.
Anyway, that was a total tangent. You were telling me about growing up in
It's entirely relevant. It's entirely relevant. wait, no, that's amazing. Because I was reading that you went to college and then you co-founded this political rock band called Outer National, and you recorded an album produced by Tom Morello, personal hero of mine and Dave's. And you wrote songs about Arizona's controversial anti-immigrant laws. And so when I saw that, I was like, wow, like what's the connection here? And I realized that you went to school in Arizona, like at U of A. And I'm wondering what that experience was like. I know that at some point, I remember reading that you said that you kind of got burned by that experience because you had a major label deal with Warner Brothers. And I'm just so curious about what that whole process was like, because you went from, what did you study in college?
I studied sociology and Latin American studies.
Right, right. And you were already organizing workshops to teach people about racism and sexism, and you were on the path to being an organizer, and then you fell into being a professional musician. So I'd love to hear about what that whole experience was like.
Yeah, that is true. I didn't go to music school. There was second semester of college, I toyed with the idea of majoring in music, and came to the conclusion that this is a hobby.
So Asian.
yeah. And then it came back around many years later. But instead, I majored in sociology and Latin American studies. So that wasn't necessarily like better from my parents' perspective. They're like, what's that? Like music was easier to understand
Humanities?
Than sociology and Latin
Who's
American
she?
Studies.
Yeah.
But I was sort of on a path. A path that I'm still on of being an organizer and a social justice educator. I went straight to grad school when I was 21, at a program called Social Justice Education at UMass Amherst. So that brought me to the East Coast, and 9/11 happens as soon as I get to the East Coast, and that comes with all kinds of horrors and backlash violence and just panic organizing that's happening in the Sikh community and in South Asian, Arab, and other Muslim communities. And so I find myself coming to New York a lot to get involved, to come to anti-war protests, and started feeling a real connection to New York. And, Amherst, Massachusetts, where I was at the time, was a very white place, very white liberal place, and it still is. And was good in a way because I didn't face much direct violence there after 9/11. And then every time I left, it was like very, very in my face. But it was also really isolating. So I knew I wanted to get out of there as soon as I could when I was done with my program and move somewhere where I would be more likely to find people that look like me and find activists that I can learn from, organizers and movements to learn from and learn with. And so New York was pulling me. And so very soon after I moved to New York, I met a couple of people who had a lot of similar musical interests and similarly political musical interests. And we started this band, Outer National, in 2003, and very much situated ourselves as a part of the anti-war movement. Like a lot of our first shows were protest shows. And during the RNC protests in New York in 2004, were some of our early big shows as well. We actually played, that's when I met Tom and Serge Tankian from System of a Down for the first time, because they put us on a Axis of Justice show that they were doing at the Knitting Factory with a pretty legendary lineup. And who knows like why they put this scrappy, not very good at the time band of 20 somethings on the bill, but they put us on the bill, and it was Morello doing his Night Watchman thing, which was kind of a new solo project at the time. Him and Serge played some songs together. Serge did some stuff solo. Saul Williams was there. Michael Franti and Spearhead were there. It was pretty special. And the beginning of some long relationships.
Wow, that's an iconic lineup.
Yeah, it was pretty. It was pretty special. I felt lucky. And full disclosure, I did not know who Serge was at the time.
Yeah.
But I proceeded to learn and become a very big fan of his and of Systems as well.
Well, let's talk about the album that you recorded with Tom that he produced. I'd love to know about that experience. What it was like writing and recording and then putting it out into the world, touring on it.
Well, not all those things happen because there was I don't know how much we get into that, but there was a split with that band before the process was done. The process of making the record was pretty amazing in so many ways. I think Tom brought a lot of just approaches that we never would have thought of on our own in terms of how to make a record. I think he brought a lot of Rick Rubin style producing ideas too that he had learned from having records produced by Rick Rubin. Because at the time Tom wasn't known really as a producer. I mean, he's still not really known as a producer. So I think it was experimentation for him too. And he really believed in what we were doing and was super supportive. So it was great. He would give us songwriting assignments. And then aside from that, just be there, like play the drum fill like this, not like this. Let's try doing this here. Let's try cutting this out here. A lot of simplifying, honestly. That was he was pushing
That's
us
always
to
kind the thing,
of like
isn't
get
it?
To the essence,
yeah.
like yeah. to get to the essence of a song, sort of rather than overcomplicate it with, which is what many of us musicians are accustomed to doing. It's a very, very special time, but all sort of like clouded by a pretty bad fallout with that band. Mm-hmm. So a couple of them were members of this political organization called the Revolutionary Communist Party, the RCP. From the outset, I knew I had a lot of issues with the politics of that organization. I didn't come into that relationship naive, but we had a lot of the same critiques of the world. We were against a lot of the same things, especially under the Bush administration, Iraq War, Afghanistan War. That felt like more than enough, and a lot of similar musical interests. Mm-hmm. A lot of the same favorite bands, you know, The Clash, Rage Against the Machine, Ozo Motley, a lot of different music from different parts of the world. It became clear over time that the party's line would be the band's line. Even though I didn't join somebody else's band, right? I co-founded this band, but the two people that were in that party were very hardline about it. If you're not familiar with this sort of sectarian left organization, I think it could be compared to like a religious cult, where there's like one person at the top and like what he says is truth. And then the cadre kind of like go out and deliver that truth and recruit people and build the vanguard for the revolution. So very hard line, Marxist, Leninist, Maoist, not a lot of room for humanity, honestly, like very ideologically rigid. And in particular, what brought things to a head, because I was with them for 4.5 years or so. We'd signed this major label deal with Warner Brothers, and we're making this record with Morello when things fell apart. And what brought things to a head was particularly around my spirituality and my spiritual practice, and their insistence on what they called militant atheism being one of the sort of missions of the band, including in the song lyrics. And I took issue with that, and eventually I was like, I don't want to. They would ask me to. They would sort of corner me and ask me to prove that God exists and absurd things like that, like just totally ridiculous conversations that are not useful for anyone trying to do work together. I sort of eventually was like, I'm done with these conversations. All I care about is how do we make decisions as a band. And from my perspective, we're a collective, and therefore I can block something from moving forward. And the other three of them said no vetoes on anything. And so I walked. And that was, so I walked away from the record deal, which, you know, they were dropped from Warner Brothers within, I'm not sure, within a few months of that. And I don't know how much had, I really don't know the circumstances of that. But you know, nobody made me sign any NDA, so I can say whatever I want.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty intense band breakup.
Dude. Yeah, it was not a game. But you know, plenty of lessons learned in terms of, you know, politically speaking, I'm generally into casting a wide net, but like a lot of my friends in the movement at the time were sort of like, dude, what did you think was going to happen? like starting a band with RCP members, like it's not just like, that's not like, that's a very particular kind of like, you know, wingnut is something, sometimes the term we use for like really hardline, far left, authoritarian communist types. And that's very much, and you know, they're not a monolith, and it's like, there was a lot of beautiful things we created together, and some good work we did together too. But you know, my music, my artistry, my humanity is not to serve a party line or Absolutely. Some white guy named Bob Avakian.
Man, well, thank you for being so open and vulnerable with that answer. That's really amazing that you went through that, and I'm so sorry that it had to
a
be
a lot more than you
wanted
to know.
No, this is what we do want to know. You know, like that's an intense band breakup, and it's shocking that it was like that the line was that hard. You know,
yeah, big time.
Well, I'd love to hear about another band that you're involved in that you seem a little more aligned with, considering you've been playing with them for a number of years now, Red Barat, that I was very lucky to catch this summer in Maplewood, New Jersey, close to where I live. And you guys absolutely crushed it. It's such a unique sound. It's so big. Like, it's so huge, and just like the rhythms and the energy is like unparalleled. I'd love to hear how you got hooked up with Red Barat and what it's been like to play with them for, I guess, like 15 years now.
Yeah, 15 years. I'm old.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, timing is fascinating, because I left Outer National and I was like, all right, I'm going back to full-time organizing. Music is a hobby. And like simultaneously, a musician friend of mine named Sonny Jane, also named Sonny, but he spells his with a U. I spell mine with an O. Had this idea of putting together a brass band to play at Indian and Pakistani weddings as a procession, because that's a thing that happens in Punjab and other parts of South Asia as well, where there's a brass band and dhol players playing at wedding processions. So it started off as and actually this probably overlapped with Outer National a little bit when we started playing weddings specifically. And so it was all covers, you know, playing Bollywood songs, Punjabi songs, at weddings, because that's what people want to hear. Mm-hmm. These, you know, fun, like 30 to 45 minute processions where everyone's dancing and whatnot before the ceremony. Musicians were great, vibes were great. So, you know, a lot of fun, but I certainly at that moment, you know, 2007, 2008, didn't think it was going to turn into much more than that. And over time it became clear that there was a vibe, and a niche that like we were kind of tapping into something that nobody else in New York or maybe in the US was really doing, which is sort of bringing brass and dhol and sort of funk, and like a jazz, like improvisational jazz sensibility, together. And so we started playing shows on stages, and very quickly developed a consistent lineup. It was originally 9 pieces, with sousaphone holding down the bass. And yes, you know, a lot of us bringing our musical voices, to the band, you know, that was led and still is led by Sonny Jane on dhol. And you know, over time we started making records, and eventually more of us started writing for the band as well. And you know, it's like we've toured many continents at this point, and still going strong. A lot of changes over those 15 years, but a few of us from the beginning are still are still there. And it's a joyous thing, and it's an honor to be a part of it still.
Well, that brings me to my next question, which is this concept of revolutionary joy. And your latest album is called Charticala, which Dave and I absolutely love. I love the music videos you've created for it.
Thanks.
You really get a sense of this world that you're trying to build, which you have built, where you embody this infinite optimism. Mm. And I love this quote that I found of yours that says, in Sikh philosophy, there's no separation between the spiritual and the political. To fight for justice of all people, liberation is Charticala. I thought, I was so moved by that. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that in your creative philosophy and in your organizing.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, in many ways, Charticala has always been this guiding principle, because it's ancestral wisdom, right? Like it's baked into the Sikh way of life, baked into our spiritual practices, but also just like the way people in our community walk through the world at our best, you know? And I never really had deeply considered that actually this is a big part of the reason I'm a musician, right? Like, and why I've dedicated so much of my life to making music. And it's in part to lift my own spirits. Right. And as I was saying, like in 2018, I started revisiting, you know, the Sikh devotional poetry and these Shabads, in part to try to make meaning of what was happening and to find some respite, to find some solace and lift my own spirits in dark times. And in doing that, that lifts us collectively. And so I see that as a sort of, as a mission, as a guiding light, as a North Star of my artistry. And so I had to make a record called Charticala, and I had to write a song called Charticala. It felt necessary. And so, you know, I think as this project develops and grows, and as we play it live now, that is the focus, right? Like, is it lifting us together, and not just lifting us so we feel better, you know, feel some happiness or escape from what's going on, but actually as a way to ensure that we stay engaged. Like for six, spiritual enlightenment or getting closer to the divine or getting closer to truth or whatever you want to call it, isn't going off into the woods and divorcing ourselves from society, but it's by acting, right? Like we have to be present, right? And so when I think about the desperate times that we're in right now, I think about unfolding genocide in Gaza, like, you know, just watching Democracy Now! Or scrolling on Instagram every morning and, like, you know, breaking down basically. You know, if we give in to despair right now, if we who are not directly implicated in this, right, we give in to despair, we're giving up on the people of Gaza, right? We're giving up on the Palestinian people. We're giving up on oppressed and occupied people all over the world if we give in to despair, because despair means we're hopeless, right? Mm-hmm. And hopelessness means we're not active, right? Like we're incapable of acting. And so it's sort of a political, spiritual, human mandate to stay determined, to keep our heads high. And that's what Charticala is. And like, I can draw that wisdom from my ancestors who've been through a lot worse than I have, right? And still kept their heads up high. And so that's, you know, it's a bold mission, but that's like what I want to do through my music. I'm recording a new album right now. I was just in LA for about 10 days, getting started on the recording process. And I hope it's going to be all Sikh devotional music, actually. But in a similar spirit of, you know, ignoring genres and the way things are usually done and whatnot, and doing it in my own way with my own sort of aesthetic sensibility. And that's my hope, that it'll continue to lift me and in turn, hopefully lift us.
Oh, well, I really needed to hear that. And your work absolutely does uplift others. And I'm so grateful that your artistry exists and your message exists to connect other people and to remind us all of the power that we have as artists. Sunny, thank you so much for spending your time with us today and for sharing your work and your vulnerability with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Thank you again to Sunny for joining us on the show today. You can find him on Instagram at Sunny Singh, and his most recent album, Chadi Kala, is available now. Please subscribe, follow, rate the podcast on whatever platform you listen. Your engagement really, really helps us make the show better and make it more visible to others who might be interested in it. We love hearing from you. Tell us what you think about the show and who you'd like to hear us interview next. Send us a message on Instagram at goldenhourpod or email us at goldenhour@gmail.com. Golden Hour is created by me and produced and edited by Dave Yim, proudly part of the Potluck Podcast Collective.
Happy New Year, everybody.
Thank you so much for listening, guys. See you in 2024.